This is an Audio Holdings production.
Those Bloody Bells of Hell by H.A. DeRosso. Performed by Christopher Graybill. Red Miriam came into the palace and stopped inside the swing doors, blue eyes searching the room. The fetid warmth of the place swam about him as he let his glance go over the line of tables up against the wall, probing the sitters at each table. His eyes moved to the left, to the crowded bar. One of the two sweating bartenders, catching Miriam's glance, nodded toward the rear. Miriam started across the barroom with long, lithe strides, the big rowels of his fancy Mexican spurs jingling. Tobacco smoke eddied about him, and the air was filled with the soft murmur of voices, an occasional laugh, and the stench of sweating bodies. At the rear of the palace were three rooms. The door of one was ajar. Miriam aimed for that, and paused on the threshold, one hand resting on the jamb. The room was bare. There was a lone scratched pine board table and six chairs. Two horse drawings, almost obliterated by dust, were nailed on the wall. Flakes of whitewash littered the floor like snowdrops. A man sat at the table, a half-filled whiskey bottle before him. He sat slumped in the chair, his long legs thrust under the table, and he lifted his eyes only long enough to recognize Miriam, then dropped them to the tabletop again.
"I thought I'd find you here," Miriam said.
Barroom sounds kept swimming in, and Miriam, frowning, turned his head that way a moment.
"About time for the wedding, ain't it?"
The voice was that of a man out in the bar.
"Hell no. Got another hour yet,"
another man said.
"Shut the damn door," said the man at the table.
Miriam stepped ahead and kicked the door shut with his heel. Flakes of whitewash floated down on the table. Miriam swung one of the chairs around opposite the man at the table and sat down, straddling it, his chest against the back. Reaching out, he grabbed the bourbon bottle and took two deep swallows. He sighed with pleasure and put the bottle back.
"Ah, well, anyway," said Miriam, "you're drinking good stuff."
The man at the table lifted bloodshot eyes that seemed sunk deep into his gaunt, narrow face. Black beard lined his cheeks and chin and ran down his neck. He combed long, rope-burned fingers through his thick black hair. A thin frown clouded his brow as he studied Miriam, noting for the first time the thin alkali dust that hung on the man's clothing.
"Well," Miriam said, "what you gonna do, Lynn?"
"I'm killing the dirty son of a bitch,"
Lynn Carmody said. Miriam sighed. He made a small abortive gesture with his right hand and sighed again.
"Now what you want to do that for, Lynn? What's it going to get you? You'll have to hit the Hootie Owl Road. Let her marry Wiley Barrow and leave it like that."
Carmody stirred in his chair, eyes darkening.
"I didn't say I was killing him right away."
"Oh,"
Miriam said, breathing the word. Then, as the significance of it struck him, he said it again, even more softly.
"Oh, I didn't know that you could hate that way, Lynn."
It was there, strong in Carmody now, bringing a raging tension in him. He threw up his head, eyes glittering.
"He took my girl from me while my back was turned. Why shouldn't I hate him? He took Louise from me. I'll kill him for that."
"Well, he's your clay pigeon," said Miriam.
Carmody studied the other again. The dust lay thick on the flat crown of Miriam's hat, some of the powder trickling over the rim as the man inclined his head. Carmody's eyes ran swiftly down Miriam's body, taking in the gray flannel shirt and black vest, and resting on the big, black-handled dragoon colt at the man's right hip. On the opposite hip, in a buckskin sheath, he wore a bone-handled bowie knife. Miriam had always been partial to knives, and it was this about him that had never appealed to Carmody.
"What do you want with me?"
Carmody asked suddenly. Miriam came up at that. His blue eyes glittered evasively, then his breath came out in a wheezing sigh.
"I've got something big, Lynn, down in Viejo, Mexico."
His fingers tightened around the back of the chair until the knuckles were white.
"Big enough for the two of us. Forget about Wiley Barrow and Louise. This is big enough to make you forget everything."
It was still stirring deeply inside Carmody. It had been like this for a month now, boiling inside him, filling him with hate. He didn't like hearing it talked about all the time.
"Will you stop talking about Wiley and Louise, Red, or get the hell out of here?"
"Two bells, Lynn,"
Miriam said, ignoring Carmody's statement.
"Solid gold, both of them. A quarter ton of gold. That's what I got down in old Mexico."
Carmody's eyes narrowed. He took a long look at Miriam's flushed face and the big freckled hands gripping the chair so tightly. Some of the man's fever came to Carmody. He could feel it begin tingling the back of his neck.
So that's where you've been the past 2 weeks. How did you find these bells?
I got hold of a map. The Mex was drunk and an easy mark. It was one of these old Mexican derroteros, and I thought, what the hell, I had nothing to lose, so I bought it off him. It looked real enough.
A derisive smile twisted Carmody's lips.
So that's how it is. A map to buried treasure. They're floating over the whole Southwest. Maps to the lost Brave Fogel and Jean Lafitte's booty and Steinheimer's millions. I never thought you'd fall for that line.
But I've seen the bells, Lynn. I've used the map and I've seen the bells. I've touched them with my hands.
There was no doubting the man's sincerity. It showed in his glowing eyes, in the hot, excited flush heating his face, in the hoarseness of his voice.
You've seen them and touched them, Carmody said slowly. No one but you knows where they are. Yet you're telling me about it, offering to cut me in. That's not like you, Red.
Miriam laughed, a short, embarrassed bark.
All right, it isn't like me. But those bells are so damn heavy, I can't handle them alone. I need another man, one I can trust. You, Lynn, they're solid gold, enough to put both of us on Easy Street for the rest of our lives. I don't mind splitting with you. There's enough of it for that.
Where are these bells? Carmody asked.
In the Sierra Pintada range. There's an old story about them. Seems they were made by some padres 200, maybe 300 years ago. They're beautiful, Lynn. Solid gold with elaborate etchings all over the outside. All gold, even the clappers. Seems like the padres had made them for a present to the big auger riding the throne in Spain in those days. But I guess they didn't treat the Indians any too good, and they was laying for the Spaniards. They ran into an ambush and buried the bells when they saw there wasn't a chance of getting out of it alive. They made a map, and it got lost, and I finally found it. Convinced yet, Lynn?
Yeah, Carmody said slowly, getting to his feet. I'm convinced, even though you may have garbled the details a little.
Then you come. We can leave right away.
Not right away, said Carmody, a dead look coming into his eyes. I've got a little chore first.
The chair rasped harshly as Miriam lurched to his feet. He moved in close to Carmody, clutching at the man's sleeve.
No, Lynn, don't be a fool. Those bells...
Carmody pushed out with his hands, caught Miriam in the chest, sent him teetering back until he brought up against the table.
You keep your damn hands off me, Red!
Carmody shouted, the cord swelling in his neck. Miriam's lips twitched back from his teeth. He crouched there, half sitting on the table, left hand clenched about the bone handle of his buoy. His blazing eyes took in the man, standing straight and tall before him. Carmody towered 2 inches over 6 feet. The big, wooden-handled Remington 44 dangled at his hip, and the palm of his hand kept brushing against the butt. Miriam took his fingers off his buoy.
All right, Lynn. All right.
Carmody took the alley to the rear of the St. Joe Hotel. A flight of steps ran up the side and into the back of the second floor. Carmody went up these, listening to their creaking and the shrill, mournful jingle of his spurs, thinking that all these sad, lonely sounds fitted in with the way he felt. He walked down the hall, and it struck him strange that his throat should be so suddenly dry and that sweat should have popped out on the back of his neck. At one of the front rooms, he raised his hand and knocked on the door. Someone inside said petulantly,
"Who is it?"
Carmody knocked again, louder. He heard the sharp click of a woman's heels approaching the door. Then it squeaked open, and a thin-faced, severe woman faced him. Her face paled, and she put a hand to her throat.
Lynn Carmody,
she gasped. Then the color rushed back in her features, and her voice rose sharply.
You can't come in here.
Step aside, Helen.
You go right back down those stairs, Lynn Carmody.
He gripped the edge of the door with his right hand, holding it open like that, and he said again through his teeth,
Step aside.
Yes, Helen. Step aside and let him in, said a weary voice inside the room.
Helen threw a frightened look over her shoulder, then dropped back a step, and Carmody pushed past her into the room. The weary voice spoke again.
You may go outside, Helen. I won't need you for a while.
Carmody heard the door closing behind him, but he did not look that way. He was staring at the woman who stood in the far corner of the room. She was tall, slim, and full-bosomed. The white satin wedding dress clung to the soft curves of her body.
The small dimpled chin was high, and the red lips were tight and firm. There seemed to be a shadow in the blue depths of her eyes. Her blonde hair was a golden aureole about her head. Carmody felt his breath catch in his throat. The hurt began anew. This was the day he had always longed for since he'd known Louise Durant, the day that he'd see her in a wedding gown. He had always dreamed of that day as the brightest and happiest in his life. But instead, it brought a searing hate. For in a matter of minutes, Louise Durant would be leaving this room to become the bride of Wiley Barrow.
"I stopped by to offer my congratulations," Carmody said.
She did not move.
"Thank you, Lynn,"
she said quietly.
"I came by to let you know I'm letting Wiley be."
Louise gave a long, relieved sigh.
"Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, Lynn. Thank you."
"Don't thank me. I only said I'm letting him be for a little while."
Her hand flew to her mouth, and he saw her teeth biting into her knuckle. Shrinking back, she brought up against the wall.
"Sure, that's how it is," he said, biting off the words. "Marry him. Live with him for a while. Know some of the happiness I'll never have. And when you're the happiest, just stop and think that at that moment I may be on my way to kill Wiley. I want you to live with that knowledge a while. I want you to know some of the hurt I've known. Because as sure as I'm standing here, Lou, I'm killing Barrow. When, I don't know. Maybe a week, a month, when I feel the time is right. I promise you that, Lou."
She was beating her knuckles against her forehead, head bowed, mouth contorted. Sobs racked her shoulders.
"Lynn, it wasn't that serious between you and me."
The pain was in his throat, tempering the bitterness of his words.
"Maybe with you it never was that serious. With me, it was. You were my girl since we were kids. I never looked at anyone else. I expected someday to marry you, and I thought you looked at it like that. You knew how it was with me, and you never discouraged me."
She was crying steadily now.
"I was very fond of you. I still am fond of you. But I love Wiley. That's why I'm marrying him."
Some of his fury had died, leaving him full of empty bitterness.
"Do you really love him, Lou? Or is it his ranch, his big cattle herds, his money in the bank that you love? I'm a nobody. Would you have married me if I owned a fortune?"
Someone was knocking on the door, an insistent impatience in the rapping.
"Are you ready, Louise?"
came Helen's voice.
"It's almost time."
"Well, I've had my say," Carmody said.
He took one more look at the weeping girl, wondering that her tears did not move him.
"I'm going now. I wouldn't want you to keep Wiley waiting."
The barren peaks of the Sierra Pintada seemed to hang sullenly beneath the burnished sky. Down here in the canyon, all the glaring heat of the sun seemed concentrated, bouncing off the high, jagged walls, gathering into a sultry, suffocating mass that was almost tangible close to the canyon floor. The mesquite clumps were gnarled, twisted, as though cringing from the constant beat of the sun. Even the scent of the sage held a dry, irritating tang. The two men had picketed their horses and two pack mules under the meager, warm shade of twin mesquite trees. The animals stood with drooping heads, half-heartedly flicking their tails at the flies and insects buzzing about them. The men had dug a hole directly between the two trees. Sand lay piled where they'd thrown it beside the hole, bits of quartz in it flashing dazzlingly in the sun's rays. Red Merriam crouched down in the hole, laughing up at Carmody. There was an insane tone to Merriam's laughter, the sound of it cracking now and then.
"Now do you believe it, Lynn? Now do you believe that they're real? Look at them, Lynn, and then say this is all a crazy dream."
The hoarse labor of his breathing grated in Carmody's ears as he peered into the hole. The two bells lay side by side in the hole. The sun, where it struck them, glanced off with eye-searing brightness. They were the cold yellow color of gold. Looking closer, Carmody could see the exquisite etchings on their surface, the tiny perfect crosses and figures. Carmody felt the frenzy sweeping him, the desire to laugh, to shout. With an effort, he kept himself in check, hearing the fast, hot thumping of his heart, feeling the sweat coursing down his face. Merriam lay with his arms about the bells, hugging them. The fingers of his big, freckled hands moved lightly, caressingly over the etched surfaces, and he made small, crooning sounds in his throat. A sudden wave of disgust hit Carmody.
and then the fever was gone. And, remembering, the old cold thoughts came back. For a moment, in the excitement of uncovering the bells, he'd forgotten the raw, gnawing hate in his heart, the cold, driving purpose clawing at him.
"Aren't they pretty, Leon? Aren't they the prettiest things you've ever seen? And they're ours. I tell you, I almost went crazy mad with worry over them. I was half loco most of the time for fear somebody would come riding up this canyon and notice where I'd been digging. I covered the spot so it couldn't be noticed, but always there was the crazy thought I'd slipped up somewhere and someone would come along and steal them from me."
Carmody straightened slowly to his feet. He stood there, casting a long shadow in the sun, an empty look in his eyes. His fingers were clenched into fists.
"Well, let's get those things out of the hole and on the mules," he said. "I want to get the hell out of here. This place is like an oven."
With their lariats, they snaked the bells out of their cache. Then came the back-breaking labor of lifting each bell on a mule's back and lashing it in place. Sweat streamed down the men's faces, running off their chins, and their shirts were plastered to their backs. When the last lashing had been made secure, Miriam dropped to the ground under one of the mesquite trees, groaning and puffing, wiping the perspiration off his face.
"Whew! Well, that's that," he said,
glancing up at Carmody.
"Now you know why I needed help with him."
He gazed off at the high, ragged rim of the canyon and shuddered.
"Well, I'll be glad when we're out of here. And it ain't just because of that damn sun. I won't breathe easy until we're back in Marietta with those bells. Ain't a man south of the border or north of it wouldn't hold us up if they knew what was under them tarps on the mules' backs."
"How right you are, senor,"
it was said behind them, from a clump of dried greasewood about 50 feet beyond the twin trees. Carmody turned, hand stabbing for his Remington. But when he saw them, his hand froze with the big .44 half out of its holster. His fingers came away from the butt, the weapon sliding back. Miriam rolled over, crouching on all fours, and froze like that, with his head thrust up, looking off past the trees. His breathing was a shallow, whining moan, and then suddenly he began to curse. He grabbed fistfuls of sand and scattered it around him. He thrust his head down between his shoulders and kicked with his toes at the ground. Suddenly he looked up again, and foam was flicking at the edges of his mouth. His cursing rose to a piercing scream. There were two of them, and they came down toward the twin trees, walking rapidly, though cautiously. Both were armed, one carrying an old Tyler Henry rifle, while the other, the smaller one, held a .38 Colt Lightning revolver. They stopped in the shade of the trees. The one with the rifle poked it at Miriam and said,
"Get to your feet, Cabeza Roja."
Carmody stared narrowly at the two. Both were Mexicans, wearing wide-brimmed, peak-tipped sombreros. The one with the rifle was quite old. He had a mustache and a small goatee, white as alkali. His seamed face could have served as a relief map of some rough terrain. His black eyes, watching Miriam struggle to his feet, burned with a terrible light. The other was small as a boy. He wore a charro jacket, with the gold lacing badly faded and torn in spots. The cotton shirt revealed the curvature of breast, and Carmody, suddenly startled, raised his eyes, staring again at the smooth, round face. The little one was a woman. Miriam had stopped his cursing. He, too, was staring at the girl. She colored under the hot stares of the two men, and the .38 in her hand wavered slightly.
"Raquel!"
barked the old man, and she stiffened, chin lifting, lips thinning. The old man wore tight chivaras, and above them, only an old, tattered and patched gray vest. His bare arms and chest were almost black from the sun. There was not much flesh on him, but the muscles writhed and rippled under the leathery skin.
"Get their weapons, little one,"
he said. The girl slipped quickly behind Carmody. He felt the lifting of the weight of the Remington at his hip, and looking sidewise, saw her relieving Miriam of his dragoon pistol and Bowie. The old man said,
"Let me see that knife, little one."
She passed the Bowie over to the old man, then turned, her gun covering Miriam and Carmody. The old man held the Bowie so that the sun flashed off its keen surface.
"A cuchillo is a Mexican weapon,"
he said musingly.
"Not many Yankees fancy cuchillos."
"I always pack one," Miriam said evenly.
"Comes in handy sometimes. Like, for instance."
Miriam said nothing. The flames flared in the old man's eyes.
"Like, for instance, Should I answer that, Cabeza Roja? Like, for instance, the procuring of a valuable derrotero.
Carmody turned his head and stared at Miriam. The redhead's lips twitched.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The old man brandished the knife. It made a glittering, flashing arc in the sun, and Miriam shrank back a step. The old man stepped forward, pressing the sharp point of the buoy against Miriam's stomach.
He was like a son to me,
the old man growled, face contorted.
Is this what you used on him, Cabeza Roja? Is this the cuchillo that was used on Pio Vasquez?
Sweat streaked down Miriam's face. He tried another backward step, but the old man moved with him, the keen buoy never losing contact with Miriam's belly. A frantic cry tore out of Miriam's throat.
I used no knife! He was drunk, and I stole the derrotero from him. I stole the chart. Does that satisfy you? You have the bells. What difference does it make?
We have the campanas, but Pio Vasquez is dead. All cut up by a cuchillo. He was last seen alive in the company of a Yankee, una Cabeza Roja, a redhead. I loved him like a son.
Lynn,
Miriam cried, face twisting.
Stop him, Lynn! He'll cut me open!
The taste of gall was in Carmody's mouth. A cold, rancid anger gnawed at him.
This is your party, Red. You do the talking.
Carmody looked at the girl, catching her eyes on him, but she glanced away quickly, then back to him, and those brown eyes were again cool and impersonal.
You, Senorita, dig at me! Listen to me!
Begged Miriam, almost babbling now.
Talk to the viejo! Tell him how it was! I stole the derrotero from Vasquez! I used no cuchillo! I swear to the Madre de Dios I didn't! There must have been others who knew he had the chart. They must have reached him after I'd stolen it. They used the knife on Vasquez, not me!
Lies!
The old man snarled, pressing on the knife.
Do you think I am that great a fool? How do you like the taste of a cuchillo, Cabeza Roja?
Blanco.
It came from the girl, startling Carmody. His glance whipped back to her. She stood with chin firm and shoulders squared. There was the stamp of authority about her that seemed out of place with one so small and young. Blanco stiffened, easing up on the knife.
Blanco!
Snapped the girl again, and the old man took the knife away a little.
I loved him like a son, Raquel.
And he was like a brother to me, Blanco. Perhaps the Cabeza Roja speaks the truth.
He lies. I can see it in his eyes.
The girl's voice was forceful.
Perhaps he lies. Perhaps he tells the truth. Put away the cuchillo, Blanco, and then bind them.
Blanco whipped back his arm and threw the buoy. Miriam screamed, jumped violently aside as the knife flashed past him to thunk into the trunk of a mesquite tree.
You squeal like a pig, Cabeza Roja,
Blanco laughed.
Have no doubt, had I thrown the cuchillo at you, you would not have leaped aside.
Bind them,
Raquel ordered. Carmody felt her eyes on him again and turned his head that way. This time she did not look away. As Blanco removed the lariat from Miriam's saddle and began tying the man, the girl directed her words at Carmody.
Perhaps because I am a woman, my heart is not as cold as your compadre's, senor. Or my Blanco's. We should shoot the two of you and leave you here, but it is not in my heart to kill you. We shall bind you and leave you here. In time you will be able to free yourselves. We shall leave your horses here, and also your pistols, though not your carbines.
Blanco had finished with Miriam, who now lay flat on the ground, bound hand and foot. Blanco took Carmody's lariat, slipped behind him, began swiftly tying his hands.
When you are free, senor, Raquel continued, do not attempt to follow us. We shall have your carbines. You shall have only your pistols. I shall not stop Blanco again from killing you. Take heed, senor.
It was as the girl had said. She and Blanco rode off, driving the two mules with their heavy loads, leaving Carmody and Miriam bound on the sand. They quickly rolled toward each other, back to back, and began working at their bonds, but the old man had knotted them well. It was 2 hours later that they had finally freed themselves and rose, aching and cramped, to their feet. They found their six-shooters and shell belts on a rock. They strapped on the belts. Miriam walked over to the mesquite tree to retrieve his buoy. The knife had penetrated the wood deeply, and Miriam had to tug hard to remove it. Holding the weapon in his hands, he ran a calloused thumb along the keen edge of the blade, his eyes hot and brooding. Carmody had walked over to his mare.
He swung up into the cack. The sun had gone down behind the canyon walls, and long, jagged shadows were crawling across the floor. Already, coolness prevailed in the air. Miriam was still fingering the buoy. Carmody watched. Distaste filled him again, and his hand began to itch for the butt of his Remington 44. Finally, Miriam put the buoy back in its sheath and mounted his bay. Carmody spoke. The thing he felt inside, the cold, biting contempt, edged his voice.
So you stole the Derrotero. So that's how it was. I hate your yellow, crawling belly, Red.
Miriam reined his bay around, facing Carmody. Color flooded the redhead's face. His voice held a tight, warning ring.
Watch your talk, Lynn. I watch nothing, Red. You yellow pig-sticking son of a bitch. You use that knife on Vasquez. That's the only way you could have got the Derrotero.
Miriam's hand twitched back toward the handle of the Dragoon Colt, but the furious readiness about Carmody deterred him. With an effort, he closed his fingers about the pommel of his saddle.
I take it we're through, then. My heart never was in it. Now that I've seen how it is, I want no part of it. You're welcome to the bells, Red, both of them, if you can get them back. Me, I'm going back across the line to Marietta.
Yeah, said Miriam, sneering the word. Go back to Marietta and kill Wiley Barrow. Wind up with your neck in a noose while I live the life of Riley.
He rose in his stirrups, leaning forward toward Carmody.
Because I'm finding those bells again, and no one's taking them from me next time. No one.
You'll make sure of it with your buoy,
said Carmody, contempt curving his lips.
Is that how you'll make sure?
With my buoy, my cuchillo. I'll cut up that Blanco son of a bitch like I cut up Vasquez, and I've half a mind to cut you up, too.
Try it. Do you think I don't dare?
Carmody laughed.
I've seen the color of your guts, Red. Like Blanco said, you squeal like a pig.
The town was tucked away at the end of a canyon. Here the land fell away to gentle slopes and rugged hills, with the Sierra Pintada looming big and purple and forbidding behind them. Mesquite and sage dotted the hillsides, and down on the flats, the alkali stretched out like a gray phantom cloud. The town lay up and over both sides of the crest of a hill. It wasn't much of a town. It was comprised of sorry, mean little jacales and adobe walls, pitted and marked like the aftermath of some dread disease. Candelaria was its name. Carmody came upon it an hour after nightfall. He came upon it alone, for he had parted with Red Miriam back in the canyon. Miriam had ridden away, cursing bitterly. Remembrance of it brought a chill to Carmody, for he did not underestimate Miriam's treachery. It was Carmody's plan to stay in Candelaria overnight. The mare was tired and blowing. Weariness lay heavily on Carmody, too. So he rode slowly down the narrow, winding streets of Candelaria, looking for some presentable cantina. He passed many people on the streets, individuals in brightly colored serapes. Many of them paused to stare up at the tall, grim Yankee horseman, a tangible curiosity in their glances. It was the one who did not look up that interested Carmody. There was something familiar about the tall, peaked sombrero, the hunch of the shoulders, the litheness and grace of the walk. It came to Carmody in the instant that the other had passed him by, and Carmody reined the mare around. They were in an open field. The dark, solid blankness of brush loomed ahead, the running figure making for it. Carmody's horse, for all its weariness, fairly flew along the ground. Carmody had almost caught up with the running figure. He cried out, leaping from the running horse's saddle, striking the ground with knees bent, but even so, the mare's speed almost upset him. He went staggering forward, colliding with the figure. It had turned, and Carmody saw the bulge of a gun in one hand. He clutched for the weapon, tearing it out of the other's grasp. A toe kicked Carmody in the shins. He muffled an oath and tried to grab his assailant. Hands clawed at his face, scratching painfully. Then his fingers closed about the other's arms, whirling the figure around, holding it like that, with hands clasped behind its back. A shrill, whining moan reached Carmody's ears.
If I let you loose, will you be good?
He asked, breathing heavily.
If you won't, I'll just twist your arm some more.
The cry was burdened with hurt.
Si, senor. Si.
All right,
Carmody said, releasing the other. A tight grin touched Carmody's lips.
You're a regular hellcat. Una tigra, Raquel. A tigress.
She had whirled to face him. During the scuffle, her sombrero had been knocked off, and now her long black hair spilled down on either side of her face. Perhaps it was the shadows, her face looming pale and strangely piquant in their midst. Her eyes were dark hollows and the line of her lips a dark mark, but the delicate roundness of her face was there for him to see and admire. Raquel's voice came, a high, thin growl, turning Carmody cold with the primal quality of it.
If you were the Cabeza Roja, I would not have run, senor. I would have killed you.
That's strange, Carmody said. If you hate the redhead so much, why didn't you let Blanco finish him off this afternoon? Blanco sure had his heart set on that.
If I had let Blanco kill the Cabeza Roja, I could not have prevented him from killing you. You cannot imagine the rages Blanco is capable of. And he loved Pio Vasquez as if he were his own son.
Why should you have kept him from killing me? What was there about me, a stranger and a Yankee, to make you do a thing like that?
That is a fair question, senor,
Raquel said. She paused for a moment, looked away from Carmody, as if considering something. Then her face lifted again toward his, and she spoke earnestly.
We had been watching, Blanco and I, while you and the Cabeza Roja were digging for the bells. We had trailed you into the canyon, and it was Blanco's idea to remain concealed while the two of you did all the work, then step in and possess ourselves of the campanas. We saw and heard all that occurred. He acted naturally, senor, at the discovery of the bells. He went loco. You remained passive, senor. You looked at the bells, and no sign came from you. That is not natural. Even I was moved at the sight of the bells. If it had not been for Blanco, I would have cried aloud. Blanco, too, was moved deeply. But not you, senor. That is what puzzles me. What is there about you to make you so disdainful of so much wealth?
It came out of Carmody inadvertently.
I have a man to kill.
Oh?
The girl whispered. Wonder was in her voice.
You must want to kill him very badly. Is that why you are not with the Cabeza Roja? Is that why you were so indifferent when Blanco and I possessed ourselves of the bells?
The anger was building inside Carmody, the anger that always came when this thing was discussed. It was so much a part of him, yet he hated fiercely its obsessive grip on him. The fury broke out into his voice, putting a raw edge to it.
So, you think I am indifferent concerning the bells? Why do you think I pursued you just now, Raquel? I want to know what you and Blanco have done with the bells. True, I am no longer compadre with the Cabeza Roja. Now, if I recover the bells, they are both mine. Understand, senorita?
He could feel the weight of her eyes on him. Her voice was disdainful.
Do you expect me to inform you as easily as that?
The anger was roiling inside Carmody. Roughly, he reached out, grasping her arms.
Tell me, Raquel!
You can twist my arms again, senor. You can beat me. You can torture me. You can kill me. But I will not tell about the bells.
Frustration swept Carmody. All was confusion for a moment in his mind. He did not know what to do. He did not even know what he wanted to do. The bells did not matter so much. Memory of them was vague in his mind, as if it had all happened long, long ago. It was that other thing plaguing him. There was nothing more for him here. He raised his eyes to look for his mare and saw the gray shadow of the horse off a little way. Then there was the sudden blur of sound and movement behind him, and Raquel cried out sharply, and then they were all over him, overwhelming him. Carmody had whirled, stepping back to face their swooping rush. His hand flashed to his Remington, yanked it out, but before he could fire, they were on him. Stinking, sweating bodies crashed against him. Warm, fetid, hissing breaths exploded in his face. Carmody heard Raquel scream again. Then the cry choked off to a strangling gurgle. The Remington was torn from his grasp. He had gone down on his knees beneath their weight. There were two of them, Carmody knew now. Their arms were rapidly closing about him, imprisoning him. Carmody kicked out with a spurred boot. A hoarse, agonized scream blasted Carmody's ears, and the hold of one of his assailants loosened, then slid off. The other attacker had caught hold of Carmody's arms behind his back. They were both on the ground, threshing about on the sand. Grit got into Carmody's nose and mouth and eyes, choking and blinding him. He tried kicking out with his boots again. He lunged around on the sand, but the other held on like a leech.
Ahora, Manuel! Give it to him! Now!
Carmody sensed it coming. He seemed to feel the weight of it descending on his head even before it touched. He gave one last desperate lunge, breath strangling in his throat. Then lights flashed across his eyes, and the dim sense of searing, pressing pain, and then only the cloying blankness. The hut was a small one-room affair. The lone tiny window opened out on the misty grayness of approaching dawn. Carmody stood at the window, watching the tendrils of mist litter the ground, moving around on the slight breeze like writhing, creeping things. The breeze felt good to Carmody's aching head. He had recovered consciousness scant minutes ago, finding himself lying on the dirt floor of the jacal, his head pillowed on something soft and warm. He had looked up into the wan, drawn face of Raquel. Her cool fingers had been caressing his brow, and that was her lap on which his head had been resting. The pain lay like a solid mass, throbbing a threnody in the back of his head. The coolness eased the ache a little, though it still hurt his eyes to stare out of them. He could see the primeval thrust of the Sierra Pintada off in the gray enshrouded distance. Sage, mesquite, and cactus began taking on definite shapes as the darkness lessened, standing like silent sentinels about the jacal. There were two men, 15 feet from the jacal. One was lying on a blanket on the ground. The other stood, a straight, silent figure, the cigarette in his mouth, a red glowing dot in the shadows. Carmody took in the uniform and the rifle cradled in the man's arms and swore under his breath. Someone was standing beside him. It was Raquel. She, too, was staring out the window, and as Carmody bent his head toward her, her face lifted.
"Soldados,"
she said briefly, answering the question in his eyes. Carmody moved away from the window. His head began to ache harder as he thought, running over everything in his mind.
"Raquel," he said sharply, "what is the meaning of the soldados? What is behind those bells?"
She crossed over beside him. For a moment she was close to him, her cool fingers soothing his forehead. Then as suddenly, she had dropped back a step.
"You have a right to ask, señor,"
she said quietly.
"This is more than just a matter of an old derrotero, buried treasure, and an old man and a girl seeking it. The heart of my people is in it."
She paused as if seeking the right words.
"Have you ever seen a peon, señor? Have you seen how they live? But that means nothing. You must be a peon to understand the inhumanity of it. We are beaten. We are starved. We are no better than slaves. The whip is our reward. Torture and death our punishment."
Carmody could feel her eyes on him, as if studying him, weighing him. It made him slightly uneasy. There was a sincerity about this quiet girl that was beginning to work into him.
"As you have probably guessed, Blanco and I are revolucionarios. We are many in number, but short in wealth. With the money realized from those campanas, we could purchase many guns and much ammunition."
Carmody again went over to the window, leaning his elbow on the sill, cupping his forehead in the palm of one hand, letting the air sweep some of the shadows from his brain.
"But you, a girl, and Blanco,"
he began, then stopped as the thread of thought tangled. A growing irritation at the lethargy of his mind began to stir in him.
"Why not? Por qué no?" Raquel said, spreading her hands. "We were sent to help Pio Vasquez when he informed our group of his possession of the derrotero. Who would suspect an old man and a helpless girl? But the government has many spies, and even Blanco and I were detected."
She nodded at the two soldiers.
"That is why you and I are here."
The sound was a faint rumble, barely audible, and Carmody stiffened, ears straining. One of the soldiers spoke, and his companion rose quickly from the blanket. They were both peering down the slope. The rumble grew louder, broadening into the staccato pounding of galloping hoofbeats. One soldier said something and dropped the butt of his rifle to the ground. The dawn had come, and the land lay vernally quiet in the light. The pungent scent of sage drifted into Carmody. Already, a perceptible heat was in the air. The rider pulled up in a spray of flying sand beside the two soldiers and leaped from the saddle. There was a rapid exchange of questions and answers. Then the rider's face turned toward the jacal, and his loud, satisfied exclamation was clearly audible to Carmody.
"Ah, bueno,"
Raquel shuddered.
"That is the leader. He's the one who held me up while the two soldados subdued you. He had us taken here and rode off almost immediately."
All three men were striding toward the jacal. Carmody faced the door, Raquel moving closer to him. There came the sounds of a bar being removed from the door. Then the portal swung outward, yellow light lancing into the dim room, and the three men entered. The two soldiers remained in the doorway.
The third man, the horseman, took two steps ahead of them and halted, stiff and straight.
Ah?
He said, swift eyes taking in Carmody and the girl.
Ah, what a touching tableau. Would you really protect her, Yankee?
He was tall for a Mexican, almost as tall as Carmody. Black, darting eyes were set deeply in a long, narrow face. There was a predatory look in his prominent nose and unsated cruelty in the narrow slash of his mouth. He was wearing a huge straw sombrero. From the neck down, he was enshrouded in a bright-colored serape. His black, polished boots glistened in the light from the doorway.
Who the hell are you?
The tall Mexican's lips curled.
Truculent? Already, Yankee? Why, I've hardly begun.
He straightened even more, throwing back his slim shoulders.
Pardon this apparel,
he said, indicating his clothes with a deprecatory hand.
Expediency prompts me to wear these in place of my rightful clothing.
His chin tilted, and his heels clicked loudly, sharply.
Permit me to introduce myself. I am of the Federal Army. Teniente Higinio Martinez.
Spy!
The girl hissed.
Filthy spy!
Martinez's lips tightened until they were white.
So, you don't like my apparel, senorita? I do not blame you. I have many beautiful uniforms. Ah, yes, I, Teniente Higinio Martinez, cut quite a dashing figure in my dress uniforms. Picture, if you please, senorita. Silver epaulets, gold braid, a row of flashing medals, here,
indicating his chest.
A saber of finest Toledo steel.
He broke off abruptly.
But alas, senorita, you shall never see me dressed thus. Isn't it a pity?
Anger was throbbing in Carmody's brain.
Look here, you tin soldier, he growled. Stop strutting and tell us what you want with us.
Martinez deigned a quiet, vain smirk.
How good of you to remind me, Yankee. We really must be getting on with our business. I am concerned first with the senorita.
Martinez waved a hand languidly toward the door.
If you please, senorita.
No,
Carmody said.
No?
Purred Martinez.
Perhaps you would want me to deal with you first, Yankee? I shall attend to you in good time. But the senorita comes first. The matter of her is much more pressing. Please, senorita.
No,
said Carmody again. Martinez stepped aside, beckoning one of the soldiers. The man advanced, rifle butt held high, aimed for Carmody's face.
No,
Raquel screamed.
They will beat you. They will kill you. Let me go.
She broke loose just as the soldier drove in with the rifle. Carmody whirled, feeling the brush of the butt pass his face. The force of his drive carried the soldier on past, and Carmody made a grab for the man, getting both hands on his rifle. Then he froze, a silent groan in his throat, feeling the gun barrel in the small of his back.
I would as soon shoot you, Yankee,
came the cold, emotionless voice of Martinez.
Release the rifle.
Carmody let go his grip, stepping up against the wall as the soldier threw him a vicious look and started for the door. Martinez put the revolver back beneath his serape. Raquel was at the door, covered by the other soldier's rifle. Carmody's voice was tense.
There's nothing you want with her, Martinez. Why don't you let her go?
Martinez uttered a short laugh. He motioned to the soldiers, and they led Raquel away. Martinez slammed the door and barred it in front of Carmody's face. Carmody shouted through the heavy portal,
What are you going to do with her, Martinez?
Martinez had come around to the outside of the window. His smug, vain face looked inside.
You have a window, Yankee,
he said.
Why don't you look out and see?
Carmody crossed swiftly to the window. Outside, there was a post driven into the ground that could have been used for hitching horses. The soldiers were binding Raquel to the post. Martinez walked over to his buckskin. He took a quirt off the saddle and stood fingering the whip, watching the soldiers tie the girl. The soldiers stepped back. Without a word, Martinez moved forward, quirt held high, bringing it down viciously on the girl's back. Carmody saw Raquel stiffen, and it seemed to him that he, too, could feel the sting of the whip on his own back.
Just to give you a taste of it,
said Martinez to the girl.
But you peons have such thick hides. I imagine you've all grown accustomed to the whip by now. Still, I'll wager you felt that one, did you not? You know what I want. The location of the Campanas. I have been on your trail in the Viejos these several days, but you managed to evade me until last night. I know that you and the viejo had possession of the bells. You must have them again. I want to know where. Consider this blow of the quirt, and know that I have countless more in my arm. I do not tire easily. Consider it, please, senorita. When you are ready, speak. I shall not ask again.
Martinez waved one of the soldiers over to Carmody's window. Martinez himself walked over there, a cruel smile on his thin lips.
So, the senorita has nothing for me, he said to Carmody. On the contrary, she has enough to allow me to exchange the pips of a lieutenant for those of a captain.
His eyes closed dreamily.
Capitan Higinio Martinez.
Sweat was beating Carmody's brow. He felt the harsh laboring of the breath in his throat.
Leave her alone.
Martinez shrugged.
I have sent word to headquarters in Chihuahua that I shall soon have a complete dossier on rebel activities in the entire north of Mexico. I have sent for enough troops to clean out every rebel in the northern provinces. Would I not lose prestige if all this turned out to be a fiasco? How would you make the girl talk, Yankee? Just by asking her? I, Teniente Higinio Martinez, will show you how to make her talk.
Carmody watched with dull, aching eyes as Martinez walked back to the girl. They'd removed the charro jacket, and only the cotton shirt covered the flesh of her back. With deliberate slowness, Martinez removed his serape and hung it over his saddle. Then he took his stance beside the girl. The right arm of Martinez rose high, hung a moment in the air, then descended swiftly, powerfully. The lash of the whip was a vicious, flat hiss. Carmody's eyes closed with the blow, the hurt of it seeming to sear his mind, but no outcry came from Raquel. Again Martinez raised his arm, brought it down. Carmody glanced wildly about the barren room, but there was nothing to lay his hands on. The sound of the whip came again, and a frustrated sob wrenched out of Carmody. He rushed to the window, wild eyes seeking. The soldier on guard threw a leering grin at him. Again the whip cracked, and Carmody's teeth clenched. He felt it tearing at his brain, the unreasoning madness. His helplessness doubled the fury in him. The crack of the whip came again, loud, sibilant.
No!
Carmody shouted hoarsely, leaping at the window.
No, Martinez! Stop it, you son of a pig! You obscenity, Martinez! Your father has no name! Your sister...
Yeah. A sharp, stinging slash across his face broke Carmody's frenzy, opening his eyes. He had his head thrust out the window, and Martinez had drawn his arm back for another swipe with the quirt. Carmody leaped back, the quirt cracking about the sill. The cruel face of Martinez was at the window. The black eyes were distended, the slash of a mouth peeled back from the man's teeth, his nostrils flared.
So, Martinez shouted, you would insult me, Yankee? I shall attend to you, have no fear. With the girl, it is only a matter of making her talk. With you, it shall be a matter of making you scream.
With that, Martinez whirled on his heel and strode back to the girl. Raquel hung limply in her bonds, head lolling to one side, but not a whimper had come from her. Martinez's arm rose and fell, and the whip whined again. This time a faint, hollow moan tore out of the girl.
Tell him, Raquel! Carmody cried. Tell him what he wants to know!
Yes, Raquel, tell me!
Martinez's face was diffused with blood, the veins standing out thick on his brow, the cords of his neck like cables. His arm rose and fell methodically now, the girl whimpering and crying with each blow.
Tell me, Raquel, Martinez screamed. Where are the bells? I shall beat you until you tell. Where have you hidden the campanas? Who is behind the rebellion? How many are you? Where are you concentrated? How many rifles have you? How much ammunition? What are your plans? When do you strike? Where do you strike? Digamy! Tell me!
His scream beat cadence with the whip strokes. Blood streaked the girl's shirt. Carmody gripped the windowsill until his nails hurt.
I'll kill you, Martinez!
He shouted.
I'll break your arms! I'll kick your ribs in, Martinez! Then I'll kill you!
He was trying to crawl through the window. The soldier came at him. This time there was no dodging that driving rifle butt. It took Carmody in the forehead, rocking him with searing pain, and he felt himself hurtling back into the room. The soldier grinned mockingly at him through the window. Carmody scrambled to his feet. His raving shouts filled the small room with furious sound as he rushed at the window again.
I'll stop you, Martinez! I'll tear your tongue with my hands! I'll gouge your eyes out! I'll cut your belly open and drag your guts all over hell!
The sound of the shot was a flat, snarling noise.
Carmody froze, his face in the window. The guard threw a frantic, startled look over his shoulder, rifle still held high. Martinez had pitched to his knees, his cord arm hanging limply at his side. As if a gust of wind had touched and moved him, he fell over slowly on his face. The gun snarled again. The guard at the window gave a choked, muffled cry and went slamming back against the wall of the jacal. Carmody made a frantic grab for the rifle, but the soldier had taken it with him, still grasped tightly to the ground. The other soldier, who had been standing beside the girl watching Martinez, was racing madly for the shelter of some mesquite. The gun roared a third time, and the soldier went sprawling on his face in the sand. A man came down from a rise. Carmody saw the white hair and white goatee, the brown leathery skin, and the name came out of him in a loud cry,
Blanco!
Blanco walked over to Martinez. With the toe of his boot, the old man turned Martinez over.
So, said Blanco, still trembling with rage, you would flog my little one, would you?
His heel made a sickening crunch as he grounded into the dead face of Teniente Higinio Martinez. The land lay desolate under the beat of the sun. Saguaro cactus reached supplicating arms toward the burnished sky. Mesquite and greasewood were lonely, solitary dots scattered here and there on the sand. There was no patch of shade big enough for a jackrabbit to stretch in. Carmody had sweated over the loading of the bells for the second time. On this occasion, it was Blanco who helped him. The man was old, in his 60s, Carmody thought, but those muscles rippling under his skin were like steel cables and just as strong. Blanco's breathing was only slightly ragged by the time they were through. Raquel lay to one side on a blanket watching them. Her face was pale. Her eyes clearly indicated the agony she had endured and the hurt she still experienced, but no word of complaint had come from her lips. She had explained to Carmody. After she and Blanco had taken the bells, they had had the feeling of being followed. Knowing that spies would be watching and not wanting to risk moving the bells by themselves, they had reburied them here. Then Raquel had gone to Candelaria to summon help, while Blanco remained to guard the bells. When Raquel did not return, Blanco set out to seek her. Raquel glanced at the lowering sun, then at Carmody, who sat beside her.
Our escort should be here at sundown. Then you shall be free to go, senor. Blanco would have released you back at the jacal, but he needed someone to help with the bells. We want to be prepared so that we can leave instantly when the escort arrives. Martinez has alerted the Federalistas, and we must hurry.
She began tracing aimless patterns in the sand.
Where will you go, senor? Back to your country? Back to your home?
Back to my home, Raquel, said Carmody, that bleakness coming over him again. Blanco was sitting off by himself to one side. The Henry rifle was held across his knees, and at his feet were Carmody's shell belt and holstered Remington 44. At his back lay the rim of a wash that wriggled crookedly out into the desert, like the trail of a snake in the sand. Beyond that, there was only a glaring emptiness. Carmody stared at Blanco, watched the nodding of the huge sombrero. Then he looked beyond the old man, and suddenly his blood froze. The man had come up out of the wash, crawling on his belly, as silent as a cat stalking its prey. He was directly behind Blanco. Carmody opened his mouth to cry out, but it was too late. The man leaped to his feet, the huge long-barreled dragoon Colt in his right hand. Blanco sensed the peril, his head lifted, his fingers gripping his rifle. But before he could move, the long barrel of the Colt flashed down. A retching groan clawed out of Blanco. Again the long barrel of the dragoon fell, smashing against Blanco's skull. He toppled forward, a slight limp figure on the sand. Carmody had lurched to his feet, started to rush forward. The dragoon Colt barked harshly, the slug plowing a furrow in the sand in front of him. He pulled up short, curses choking in his throat.
Damn you, Red!
Carmody raged, the whole of him shaking with fury.
Damn you, for the sneaking bushwhacking killer you are!
Miriam was planted with legs spread wide, the dragoon centered on Carmody's belly. Miriam was hatless, his red hair wild confusion.
Serves him right, Miriam said. He should have killed me when he had the chance.
His glittering eyes flicked briefly, covetously, to the heavy packs on the two mules.
Turnabout is fair play, I always say. Blanco let us load the mules for him once before he stepped in. I've been down in that wash for an hour, waiting for him and you to load 'em again. Now they're mine again.
Raquel was sobbing brokenly behind Carmody. He looked about him. There was nothing hopeful to see. His mare and the mounts of Raquel and Blanco were off to the left with the mules.
Miriam's spread legs straddled the Henry rifle and Carmody's carbine and .44 that Blanco had been guarding.
"What's the matter, Red?" Carmody derided. "Lose faith in your buoy? Then all the while it's just been bragging about how good you were with it. You and your cuchillo. What does it have to be before you use it on a man? Does he have to be tied and helpless? Didn't I hear you say once you had half a mind to use it on me?"
The redhead snarled.
"You pushed me around in Marietta, and I took it. You pushed me around in the canyon, and I took it. You think you can keep pushing me around all the time?"
He fished in his pocket with his left hand and took out a pigging string. Tossing it at Carmody's feet, Miriam beckoned with his head at the girl.
"Tie her up," he ordered. "Tie her good. I don't want her running around loose while I'm cutting you up."
Carmody obeyed. Raquel whispered over her shoulder,
"Don't do it, senor. You haven't a chance. Your bare hands against his cuchillo. Please, senor."
"He'll kill me anyhow," Carmody said,
drawing the knot, feeling the hurt himself as the girl winced.
"Have no fear. He's yellow clear through."
He raised his voice at the last, and Miriam heard. Anger flushed his face.
"Step away, Lynn,"
he said, his voice quivering.
"Let me check the knot, and then we'll see if you'll take me."
Miriam tested the knot with his left hand. Then, with the dragoon, he motioned Carmody away from the girl.
"Keep walking, Lynn," Miriam said. "I'll tell you when to stop."
100 yards from the guns, Miriam said,
"All right, Lynn."
Carmody halted, facing Miriam. The man took his dragoon by the barrel and cast it as far as he could. Then the buoy glittered in his hand.
"How do you like the look of it?"
he said, crouching.
"It's sharp. I can split a hair with it. I always keep it that way."
Miriam came in at a crouch, shining buoy held against his thigh, the keen point slanted upward. Carmody's eyes seemed mesmerized by the point of the knife. With an effort, he tore his glance away, fastened it on the lithe, cat-like approach of Miriam. Carmody took a step aside. Miriam swerved with him. They were close now, Miriam 5 feet away. Suddenly, Carmody leaped, foot kicking out for Miriam's knife hand. The man shouted, voice hoarse and startled, dropping to the ground and rolling away. He came swiftly to his feet, sand dripping from his clothes. His breath panted wheezingly. He came in cat-like, fainting to the left with his knife. When Carmody moved with him, Miriam straightened swiftly, leaping in with the buoy held high. Carmody's hand lashed up, hitting Miriam's wrist, deflecting the buoy. Even so, Carmody felt his sleeve rip, then the sharp sting of the cut on his arm, and the warm flow of the blood. Carmody had wheeled in close to Miriam, chopping a short blow hard against Miriam's nose. The redhead jumped back, holding his bloody nose.
"That's the first cut, Lynn,"
Miriam said, his voice thick through his smashed nose. Blood dripped down over his lips.
"How did the buoy feel? How was the taste of it?"
He began circling slowly in that crouch again, blade against his thigh. Carmody pivoted with him. Blood soaked Carmody's sleeve. The breath kept laboring out of him. Suddenly, Carmody kicked his boot deep into the sand, spraying the grit over Miriam. The man sputtered, choked, the knife slanting aside a moment, and Carmody rushed in. With his left hand, he clutched for Miriam's knife wrist, gripped it. Carmody got both hands around the wrist, hanging on tightly. Miriam whirled, trying to shake Carmody loose. The buoy lifted high, both men straining. The waning sun flashed off the blade. Sweat drenched the two men. They were close together, faces an inch apart.
"What are you gonna do when I've taken the buoy from you, Red?"
Carmody panted. Miriam spat in Carmody's face, mouthing an obscenity.
"You'll never see the time you can take my buoy!"
Carmody sensed it, but it came so swiftly he could do nothing about it. The knee ground into his groin. With a groaning effort, he submerged the sickness. His grip on Miriam's wrist became a hold of steel. Carmody swung Miriam spinning in a circle, a shout roaring out of him. Then he stepped in swiftly, bearing down hard on the wrist, snapping Miriam's arm behind his back. Miriam's breath was spasmodic, filled with retching agony. Carmody summoned the rest of his strength. He swung Miriam's arm back, hearing the man's tortured scream blast his ears. Then Carmody swung the man's arm in toward him, the buoy aimed straight. Miriam's shriek was a wailing, anguished howl that ended as the buoy sank up to its hilt in his back. Raquel knelt beside Blanco, her face buried against his chest. She heard the approaching footsteps behind her, and the sobs froze in her throat, and a tenseness came over her.
"It's me, Raquel," Carmody said quietly.
She jumped to her feet, trying to turn around, but Carmody held her away until he'd untied her hands. She was laughing and crying, all mixed together.
Oh, senor, senor, she cried. I was so afraid. I could not bear to watch. Oh, senor, it is you and you're alive.
After she had bandaged the cut on his arm, Carmody took hold of her. He looked down into the round delicateness of her features, feeling a strange regret.
The bells mean much to you, don't they, Raquel? The cause of your people means so much.
It is my life itself, senor. I live for nothing else but the day that we shall be free.
Bleakness entered Carmody's eyes. The old bitterness came back to his voice.
There's just one thing I live for, too.
A sadness tinged the girl's voice.
To kill your man?
Carmody nodded.
To kill my man.
The escort arrived at nightfall. There were five of them. Carmody and Raquel had buried Blanco. Raquel made a few hurried explanations to the five. Then she swung up on her horse. The five were already leading the laden mules away. Raquel held out her hand, and Carmody took it in both of his. She leaned there a moment in the saddle, and he thought he glimpsed a sadness in her eyes. There were words in him to say, words that came from deep down inside, but it all choked up in his throat. Gently, Raquel withdrew her hand, and without a word, rode away. Carmody watched her go. The night swiftly swallowed her. He swung aboard his mare. His carbine was in its boot beneath his left leg, and the Remington hung heavy at his right hip. The border was 30 miles away. Marietta, about 40.
Well, Carmody, what are you waiting for? He thought. She's gone. You'll never see her again. Start for the line now that it's night and cool. You can be in Marietta tomorrow. Then you can square accounts with Barrow. It's what you wanted, isn't it?
Suddenly, the shots rang out, dim with distance, scattered ragged volleys echoing across the sands. Carmody grew tense in the saddle. The firing continued, the steady, monotonous shooting of a pitched battle. Carmody touched spurs to the mare, heading south. From the top of a rise, he saw the scene of battle. It was laid out below him like a giant wheel. The hub of it was where Raquel and her escort must be forded up. The rim was the ring of Federals surrounding them. Lances of gunflame were spokes. He pulled the carbine from its boot, stepped off the mare to the ground. He patted the critter's neck and struck out a foot.
Go back, Carmody, go back,
his mind kept telling him.
Marietta is where you belong. Go back, Carmody.
The firing was closer now. He could smell the acrid odor of black gunpowder. A sense of urgency possessed him. It was Raquel in his mind. Raquel of the soft features and softer voice. Raquel, the uncomplaining. Raquel, the gentle and firm and purposeful.
I've got to know, was the thought running urgently through his mind. I've got to know how it comes out. I can't ride off with you in a tight like this, Raquel. I want to be with you. I want to fight beside you.
The roar of the battle was loud in his ears. He could see the shadow of a soldier ahead. A strange contentment filled Carmody as he dropped on his belly and began crawling forward on the sand.
This has been an Audio Holdings production.